Appendices. Notes on the Basics of Meteorite Research. One note. For your convenience, these appendices will also be reproduced in the enhancement. Appendix 1. The Taxonomy Man Cometh. As covered in the main chapters, studying the orbital dynamics of asteroids might be able to save our species from an untimely exit. And the scientific information available in meteorites can teach us loads about how we got here in the first place. But that first requires recognition and classification. Meteorites are not just a single type of rock that happens to fall from space, but are, by almost any measure, far more diverse than any rocks formed on Earth. Some meteorites have such high percentages of water that they could have been the source of Earth's oceans. Yet some are so dry they gain water just by sitting around on Earth's surface. Other types contain so much organic material that they may have provided the building blocks of Earth's biosphere. Others have never been melted and contain fossils of long-dead stars and the first objects to form in our solar system. And some look just like rocks erupted from a Hawaiian volcano, but are from Mars. To classify something as a meteorite is just the first step, recognizing that it was not formed on Earth. Consider watching the original Star Wars movies with the characters having no names, backstories, or connections to any other characters. Sure, Han Solo would still be cool, but he is far more compelling when you find out he made his living as a smuggler, won his ship gambling with a guy named Lando, who later both helps and betrays him, all the while being heavily indebted to a gangster named Jabba the Hutt. It is just simply a better story because of the organization and connectivity of the characters. Likewise, the natural world we live in, including the cosmos, is a complicated web of networks. Without organizing and connecting things, we have little hope of understanding big-picture problems or the story of our natural world. As such, our best chance of understanding anything in such a complicated system rests on the shoulders of taxonomy, the science of classification. In terrestrial geology, there are three main classifications into which all rocks fall. Even most non-geologists learned these terms at some point in their science education: igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic, the tri-pillars of the rock cycle. Of the three, igneous rocks are probably the most exciting to most people, since they derive from volcanoes and, of course, liquid hot magma. In short, igneous rocks were molten before they crystallized into basically what you see today. They can have lots of shiny crystals and pretty colors, and as such, they get all the ballyhoo and fanfare. Sedimentary rocks are far more unassuming and pedestrian, the common person's rock. They form slowly over time, almost exclusively underwater, and they form either from whatever random chunks of stuff that rains down to form layers, think sandstone, or whatever is oversaturated in the water to chemically precipitate, think limestone. Metamorphic rocks are igneous or sedimentary rocks that burned the candle at both ends after they formed. These rocks chose to live a fast and hard lifestyle of pressure and heat, transforming their youthful crystals or layers for twisted and hardened and sometimes unrecognizable features only associated with a difficult existence. The classification scheme described above works well enough when applied to Earth rocks that formed where gravity, running water, and plate tectonics are the primary players that deposit, destroy, and deform them. Yet these familiar conditions of ocean sedimentation and plate tectonics do not exist in space. After all, Earth is the only known planet with oceans of water or plate tectonics. The majority of known meteorites formed in the vacuum of space, from coalescing gas and dust, and remain largely unchanged, or, alternatively, are made of almost solid metal. These are weird rocks. and weird rocks that formed under completely different environmental conditions to Earth rocks require a very different classification scheme. The well-known science fiction author and less well-known professor of biochemistry, Isaac Asimov, saw taxonomy this way. The card player begins by arranging his hand for maximum sense. Scientists do the same with the facts they gather. Stephen Jay Gould, the influential popular science writer, said, "Classifications are theories about the basis of natural order, not dull catalogs compiled only to avoid chaos." Yet, perhaps my favorite comes from the professor, Richard Blackwelder, specialist in tropical beetles and a true giant of modern taxonomy, if there is such a thing. As an aside, and to highlight what an interesting and impressive taxonomist Blackwelder was, after his retirement from his extensive etymological exploits, he chose, in his spare time, to amass everything he could find on the beloved fantasy author J.R.R. Tolkien. Over the next 20 years, Blackwelder personally collected and organized the largest body of Tolkien legendarium ever assembled. He wrote, "The study of taxonomy in its broadest sense is probably the oldest branch of biology or natural history, as well as the basis for all the other branches, since the first step in obtaining any knowledge of things about us is to discriminate between them and to learn to recognize them." Classification is now in session. Even early collectors of meteorites knew that rocks from space were very different from Earth rocks. And they knew that if we were to learn much from meteorites at all, it was crucial to recognize the similarities and differences in various samples, allowing us to understand what the various types convey about solar system formation and evolution. The current classification scheme for meteorites began in the late 1860s with the work of Gustav Rose at the University Museum, Berlin, and Mervyn Herbert Neville Storey Maskelyne of the British Museum. I would not suggest any, much less all four, of these given names for a modern baby unless you want them mercilessly teased on the school playground and routinely stuffed into various lockers and cabinets. Perhaps not surprisingly, both of these pioneers were grandsons of famous scientists and apparently had order and organization in the bloodlines. Gustav was the grandson of Valentine Rose the Elder, who created an alloy of lead, bismuth, and tin that is still known as rose metal, though presumably not because of its springtime smell. Maskelyne's grandfather, Reverend Dr. Neville Maskelyne, was the British Astronomer Royal and was the first person to scientifically measure the weight of the planet Earth. The major classes of meteorites. In order to have a full appreciation of the kinds of things that we can learn from the many different types of meteorites, it's important to understand how they are broken into their respective groups, and why. Like everything everywhere, there are competing systems. Some people are lumpers, wanting to toss countless meteorites with somewhat similar characteristics together into large bins. Some people are splitters, wanting to make hundreds of little groups based on minute differences. Whichever camp you are in, you can choose to group meteorites by physical characteristics, mineralogy, chemical and/or isotopic compositions. The list goes on. This list gets even more complicated when you consider the recent advances that have allowed meteorites to be grouped according to genetic relationships and where their parent body formed in the disk, close to the sun versus in the outer solar system. Things can be a bit confusing in detail, but here we are sticking to a more classical system. Meteorites can be divided into two main groups, just as Gustav Rose divided them over 150 years ago. Chondrites and achondrites. Chondrites got their name because, hold on, they contained something called chondrules. This seemingly primitive prose may give you the impression that space geologists lack creativity, but aside from meteorite groupings, this is not really the case. Chondrules are not something people, even geologists outside of the meteorite community, are very familiar with, simply because they don't really exist in anything but meteorites. They are complicated in detail, but are essentially just millimeter-sized round rocks that used to be little molten spheres or globules free-floating in space, hence the round shape. Chondrules make up a large portion of chondrites, often more than 80%, and can be readily identified by eye in most chondrites. Achondrites, on the other hand, do not contain chondrules. This is either because they have been melted away and their existence erased, or because they were never there in the first place. Either way, achondrites are pieces of planetary bodies that were molten at some point, forming something roughly planet-like, whose chunks were knocked off and hurled at us. Classifying rocks that never melted, the chondrites. Probably the easiest way to think about chondrites of all sorts is that they are sedimentary rocks that formed in space, not underwater, as we are accustomed to thinking with terrestrial sedimentary rocks. Early in the solar system's history, when the sun was young and planets were only beginning to form, there was a lot of gas, dust, and chunks of small rocks floating around. These seemingly random pieces of celestial sweepings gravitated together, assembling into a relatively small planetoid. Critically, for both the rocks and our classification of them, these chondrite planetoids never produced enough heat to melt their component pieces, whether because their bodies were too small to generate enough heat during their formation. They formed after most of the short-lived, heat-producing radioactivities present in the early solar system had largely decayed away, or both. Large bodies form due to the combination of many smaller bodies. When smaller bodies come together in great numbers, there are a lot of collisions that create an immense amount of thermal energy. This conversion from kinetic energy to thermal energy is generally referred to as the energy of accretion or accretionary heat. More on this topic later, but it is incredibly cool to think about how isotopes that no longer exist in the solar system were present when it started, all thanks to the behavior of different types of stars at different points in their life cycles. Regardless of why, we now have unmelted, largely pristine samples of the very early solar system in the form of chondrites. And because chondrites are largely unaltered since their formation, these samples are critical links to how the solar system formed and what it was made from prior to secondary processes like melting, messing things up and making it far more complicated to piece back together. One of the critical aspects about chondrites in general is that they have largely captured and maintained the elemental composition of the molecular cloud from which the solar system formed. How do we know this? First, we have a good idea of what the sun is made of, thanks to a baller technique called spectroscopy. In spectroscopy, basically a machine stares at a star, in this case the sun, and records the electromagnetic spectrum, that is, visible light, infrared, and ultraviolet radiation, that comes off. From the various wavelengths of this radiation, it's possible to deduce what elements are present, and therefore what the sun is made from. In the sun's case, it is a whole heck of a lot of hydrogen and helium, some oxygen and carbon, and various trace amounts of the other approximately 90 naturally occurring elements that combine to form the basis for our existence. The sun contains greater than 99.8% of the mass of the solar system, but it's important to know that the remaining scraps that the planets and meteorites were fighting over, Jupiter gobbled up most of it, are still made of the same basic materials, and the leftovers are not some exotic afterthought of solar system formation. We know this because if we measure what elements the aforementioned chondrites are made from, they have an almost perfect compositional match with the sun in all but the most volatile elements. And if you think about it, meteorites not containing the same amount of noble gases as the sun makes sense. Elements like helium, neon, and argon carry a full outer electron shell, and so they don't bond into rock-forming minerals. Basically, the most important thing that this match between chondrite meteorites and the Sun tells us is that the planets and Sun, and everything else in the solar system, are essentially made from very similar starting materials. It was just the environmental conditions present in each planetary building zone that dictated how much of each element each planet ended up with, and where on each body those elements are now stored. Of course, there were minor transfers of materials that happened later on as material was mixed about. But the gist of it is that we are all made from basically the same stuff. We have now established that the chondrites are a special breed of primitive rocks. But they are, of course, not all the same as one another and can be split into many different subgroups. For most, there are three major divisions of chondrites: carbonaceous chondrites, ordinary chondrites, and enstatite chondrites. In some ways, these are thoughtful and informative names that provide immediate information about those classes of rocks. For example, enstatite is a well-known mineral that forms when there is not much oxygen around. Such meteorites formed under what are known as very reducing conditions, or where there was little extra oxygen to spare. In some other ways, these main class names are outdated, misleading, and confusing. For instance, the term carbonaceous originated because some of the first recognized samples of this group contained abundant carbon, but many of the members of the current group actually contain very little carbon, so not such a good name after all. The dismissive term ordinary chondrites slights this class simply because it is the most common type of meteorite to fall to Earth. They are not uninteresting. They are just more abundant than the rest. The three major divisions of chondrites have much more in common than they have apart. A typical chondrite, regardless of whether it's from the carbonaceous, enstatite, or ordinary division, has three major constituents, which you can think of a bit as a timeline of its formation. The oldest constituents of chondrites are the refractory inclusions, which are generally called CAIs, whereas this is easily confused with the widely known acronym for the Central Intelligence Agency. CAI is actually short for Calcium Aluminum Rich Inclusion. This horribly clunky name is at least informative because, well, as you may have guessed, CAIs are very rich in the elements calcium and aluminum. CAIs are the oldest objects dated in the solar system, and thus their age defines its age. Because CAIs represent time zero for the solar system, they capture a snapshot of what was happening at its birth. So you can think of them as the first picture of our bouncing baby solar system. CAIs are what I have spent the bulk of my career, to this point, studying. So in an active attempt to not get into all the super interesting specifics, just realize that they are incredibly fascinating objects that give us an immense amount of information about solar system formation. If you're interested too much beyond that, you will probably need to stray into the scientific literature. Chondrules, the rock BBs mentioned earlier as the namesake of chondrites, are the second major phase to emerge during solar system formation, and therefore the second entry into our solar system's baby book. Chondrules are a major constituent of chondrites, and, more critically, they are an incredibly important phase of solar system evolution. However, as a community, we really don't yet know the exact process or processes that formed chondrules. Some people say chondrules formed from early planetesimal collisions. Some say it was from nebular lightning. Some say it was from something called bow shocks during planet formation. There are many ways researchers will tell you chondrules cannot be made. Of course, this list includes things like planetesimal collisions, nebular lightning, and bow shocks. But there is yet to emerge a clear mechanism that can satisfy the years of research on the subject. As a running tongue-in-cheek response to when someone asks how chondrules formed, the answer is frequently that chondrules formed by the chondrule-forming process, first quipped by the late John Wesson, responding to a heated discussion and question at a lunar and planetary science conference in the late 1990s. This now common response is a nice mix of 1. Obvious truth and humor, 2, recognition of our ignorance on the subject, and 3, embarrassment. But the science marches on, and strides continue to be made on the subject of chondrule formation. After all, we must keep in mind that even with the most generous definition, the field of meteoritics has only existed for a couple hundred years. For comparison, it was many thousands of years before we as humans really knew how babies were made, and that is a subject that the vast majority of the adult population appears to very much enjoy doing research on. The third major phase of a chondrite is the so-called matrix material. No, this matrix is not a series of vertically streaming green numbers in which a beautiful woman in a red dress might appear if you stare at it long enough. The matrix in a meteorite is essentially the everything else in a chondrite that is not a CAI or chondrule. The matrix in chondrites forms at a much lower temperature compared to CAIs or chondrules, and as such, contains far more volatile species than its higher temperature counterparts do. In particularly primitive chondrites, the matrix material can host loads of organic compounds. More than 80 types of amino acids have been identified in a single primitive meteorite. The matrix hosts the majority of the water in primitive chondrites, which can be greater than 20% of the meteorite's total mass. There is speculation that the water that fills Earth's oceans, or the organic material that ignited life and builds Earth's biosphere, traces back to matrix material in chondrites. Additionally, another thing found within the matrix in chondrites are something called pre-solar grains. These materials exist in different forms and different amounts depending on the type of chondrite, but are in essence fossils from stellar systems that existed before the formation of our sun. These tiny particles were swept up during the gathering of materials that came together to make our solar system and everything in it, but escaped melting and incorporation into larger objects like planets, achondrites, or even millimeter-sized chondrules. Mixed and melted together, these pre-solar materials are the building blocks of everything millimeter-sized and larger in our solar system. Unmelted, they are our link to what came before it. All three classes of our chondrule-containing friends, ordinary, enstatite, and carbonaceous, contain the three above-described CAIs, chondrules, and matrix, yet in different proportions and with differing characteristics. This is both due to differences in their original building materials and to the particular environment each chondrite experienced during its 4.5 billion-plus year existence. The individual environments that each chondrite has experienced allow samples to be broken down into types, subgroups, and clans, and they are graded based on a combination of the amount of aqueous alteration, or change caused by water, petrologic type 1 and 2, or heat they have seen, petrologic type 3 through 6. For example, something deemed a 2, example CM2, a carbonaceous meteorite of M type, is a carbonaceous meteorite that has seen a moderate amount of water, but has not seen high temperatures at any point in its existence. On the other side of things, a type 6 is a sample that has seen lots of heat, up to about 900 degrees Celsius, which could have come from a number of sources, including internal heat from radiogenic decay, or from impact on the parent body. The amount of aqueous alteration in a meteorite is important because this describes how much water the meteorite has encountered. At first, this may not seem like it would be important. Earth rocks are exposed to water all the time and are used to it. But for a meteorite, even slightly soppy conditions are a big deal. The major factor in how much water a meteorite has seen is location of formation. Essentially, how close to the sun was it when it formed? Meteorites that formed in the inner solar system, defined as the sun out to somewhere around the current orbit of Mars, are fairly dry, containing very limited water because the hot sun drove it all the way. However, many meteorites formed beyond what is termed the snow line, far enough away from the sun where water ice was abundant, and incorporated into any budding planetesimal. Meteorites of petrologic type 1 formed under such conditions and contain around 15% water. This is a lot of water, akin to what you see in a used dish rag that was poorly wrung out. These types of meteorites look and feel wet because they really are. It's a common thought that meteorites are flamingly hot all the way through when they land on Earth due to the friction entering the atmosphere. While the outer portion of the meteorites do experience a great deal of heat, the interiors are basically unaffected by entry. When meteorites land, they are not usually a hot hunk of rock, but actually very cold, because they have been stored for millions of years at negative 270 degrees Celsius. With this amount of water to start with, and greater than 4.5 billion years to react, the effects are noticeable. The boundaries between chondrules are no longer discernible in type 1 chondrites, and what remains is a carbon-rich, crumbly pile of what appears to be semi-wet rock flour. As you move up the number scale to the higher petrologic types, the less water and less aqueous alteration you have. For instance, in petrologic type 3, you have less than 3% water, and these samples maintain chondrules with well-defined borders and clear, unaltered glass present. If we go beyond petrologic type 3, we are starting to get into rocks that have seen higher temperatures than desired if you hope to maintain a pristine mineralogy. Whereas determining the peak temperature a rock has seen may seem at first a bit arbitrary, it's actually quite easy to understand if you love homemade trail mix as much as I do. If you're smart, you put in chunks of chocolate to complement the peanuts, almonds, raisins, etc. And if you are hiking on a warm day and manage to not eat the entire bag on the way to the trailhead, you will experience what I am talking about. If you reach a certain temperature, the chocolate will just be a bit soft and kind of stick to your hands when you dig in. If the bag gets a bit hotter, the chocolate chunks will have lost their original shape, and it's really starting to get a bit messy. I better eat this stuff faster. If you forego early snacking, or your hiking buddy is carrying the bag of goodies to keep you from eating it all, your midday hike could result in completely liquefied chocolate coating every raisin and peanut in the bag. This is not altogether a bad thing, as it is still delicious, but does re-inform you that you should carry your own snacks or things like this can happen. This Choco example is similar to how chondrites are graded for heat exposure. If a meteorite forms at low temperatures, say less than 100 degrees Celsius, certain mineral structures and phases will be present that indicate lower temperatures. As temperatures go up, different mineral structures and phases emerge, oftentimes erasing the lower temperature structures that are no longer stable. Because volatile components such as water can be driven out of the mineral structure as temperatures increase, these events often are non-reversible reactions that can be used as a high watermark for temperatures. As chondrites grade upward from type 3 to type 6, volatile components decrease. Water goes from around 3% to less than 1%, and there are numerous accompanying mineralogical changes. Melting commences at around 950 degrees Celsius, representing an upper limit of the stability of many minerals. If a chondrite crosses this rock Rubicon, it will lose its identity and its vaulted status as chondrite, moving itself into the melted world of the achondrites. Interesting nuggets about each type of chondrite. Ordinary chondrites. More than 80% of the meteorites found in museums and collections around the globe are classified as ordinary chondrites, so it's easy to see why they are called ordinary. It remains unclear as to why Earth receives such a high percentage of these samples. It's been logically speculated that the various source asteroids of these meteorites are located at a gravitationally advantageous position in the asteroid belt to perpetually pelt us with whatever gets knocked off them during collision, filling our museums and eBay with their planetary flotsam. If such an idea is correct, these parent bodies must be very dynamic and interesting places, because ordinary chondrites have a wide variety of characteristics. Ordinary chondrites range from petrologic types 3 through 6, showing that some have experienced virtually no thermal alteration, type 3, yet some have seen extensive heating events, type 6. Hydrous alteration has also been identified in some of the least heated ordinary chondrite samples, showing that water has played a minor role for at least some members of this group. Ordinary chondrites also vary widely in the amount of metal present, but even the most metal-poor samples still have visible chunks scattered within them. If you happen to be the type that likes walking around, sticking a magnet to everything when you go for a hike, the high metal content of ordinary chondrites makes them comparatively easy to find and recognize as meteoritic, also contributing to their outsized abundance in our collections. Enstatite chondrites. Opposite of ordinary chondrites, enstatite chondrites are some of the rarest types of meteorites known, with only approximately 200 current samples identified. As alluded to earlier, enstatite chondrites have a unique mineralogy that tells us something about their formation region. Because they are among the most reduced rocks known to exist, containing up to approximately 10% native metal grains, reduced meaning extremely low free oxygen around to be used to make oxide materials. It has been speculated that they formed near the center of the solar system, where oxygen was very hard to come by, possibly even as central as within the current orbit of Mercury. Another interesting thing about enstatite chondrites is that they are thirsty, having the lowest water content for any rock studied. Of course, this incredibly low water content also translates into another very sound argument for the idea that they formed close to the sun. Carbonaceous chondrites. I saved the best chondrite class for last. Carbonaceous chondrites are a fairly rare group, less than 5% of total known meteorites, that still manage to find themselves at the center of an overwhelming number of meteoritic studies. There are numerous reasons for the intense focus from the scientific community on carbonaceous chondrites, but it principally boils down to the fact that they are the most primitive of an already primitive class of samples. Simply put, they are archives of unsullied information from the very start of the solar system. If you have ever been to Phoenix, Arizona in July, you have likely experienced temperatures higher than some members of the carbonaceous chondrites. Because they are so pristine, these meteorites can provide a view of what our purest building blocks are. Carbonaceous chondrites are the most important hosts of pre-solar materials, fossils from long-dead stars, allowing scientists to look beyond even the immense 4.567 billion-year history of our own stellar system. Some carbonaceous chondrites contain large and abundant refractory inclusions, CAIs, providing ample material to study that first snapshot of solar system formation. Additionally, carbonaceous chondrites house an almost inconceivable variety and amount of organic molecules and amino acids, plus a lot of water. This has led many scientists to speculate that the origin of life on Earth is directly tied to the early arrival of such meteorites on our planet. The level of importance carbonaceous chondrites have played on Earth can be reasonably argued, but they are unquestionably important, and they are incredibly interesting. From a logistical standpoint, it certainly does not hurt that two of the most important of these types of meteorites are large falls witnessed by humans, both occurring in 1969. In February, greater than 2 tons of the carbonaceous chondrite Allende fell in northern Mexico. And then, to round out the summer of 69, the Murchison meteorite fell in southern Australia in late September. As discussed previously, the falls of these two spectacular meteorites coincided with a world that was abuzz about space science, thanks to the palpable and understandable excitement of landing on the moon. Laboratories around the world were being built and readied for the return and distribution of lunar samples. People were looking up and excited about outer space, and just at the right time, two incredibly scientifically interesting meteorites arrived in large quantities. All meteorites are special and, of course, deserve blue ribbons, but from a value standpoint and the information contained within them, carbonaceous chondrites are the bee's knees. Classifying rocks that melted, the achondrites. As you may have just learned, achondrites are meteorites that have been exposed to enough heat to melt at some point in their existence, so they do not preserve pristine textures like chondrites often do. In fact, many achondrites are basalts, which are one of the most common types of igneous rocks one might stumble across on tramping over Earth's crust. This fact makes recognizing their meteoritic origin sometimes difficult. But hark! There is an easy way to tell a meteoritic basalt from a terrestrial one. Terrestrial basalts do not, as a rule, fall from the sky, whereas meteoritic ones exclusively do. When this method fails and achondritic candidates are located that were not witnessed falls, they undergo a variety of tests to unveil their provenance. Among other techniques, this is done by looking at the iron-nickel ratio of the rock. In general, meteorites have far higher amounts of nickel compared to terrestrial rocks, and this can be a good indicator of its origin. Achondrites may have had their original textures erased by melting, but that does not mean they are all the same. By many measures, achondrites are significantly more diverse compared to their chondritic cousins, representing countless planetary bodies that largely fail to make it all the way to planethood. Those tossed within the fairly broadly grouped term of achondrites include chunks of disrupted planets and planetesimals that range from crusts to mantles to iron cores. This list includes the hundreds of pieces of Mars and the Moon, each with their own clear differences, we have in our collections. Somewhat similarly to chondrites, each achondrite can also be classified by how weathered or fresh it is, or how disturbed by shock it has been. These things were launched off a fairly large chunk of rock, after all. As you might expect, those with low weathering and shock grades are more prized if one is looking for original information about the parent body of the meteorite. However, when layered with other information like the age of the rock, things like weathering and shock can also tell us a great deal about the conditions present over the course of the solar system. Thus, all space rocks can be informative archives. It just depends on what questions you are most interested in answering and interrogate the rocks appropriately. Interesting nuggets about some achondrites. Iron meteorites, samples of cores. When many people think of meteorites, iron meteorites come to mind because meteorite hunters can easily identify them when searching with a metal detector or magnet. As pieces of almost pure metal, iron meteorites are straightforward to identify and recognize as not normal rocks. There are some man-made samples that can look similar to iron meteorites, industrial slag waste from steel production, for example, but for the most part, irregular solid chunks of freeform metal are not the norm in our world and stand out as something special when they are seen on the ground. Iron meteorites are interesting for several reasons, but first and foremost, they represent something that we have no access to on Earth: planetary core material. The core of Earth, the interior metal marvel that gives us a magnetic field, starts approximately 2,900 kilometers, 1,800 miles, below Earth's surface. Since there is 2,900 kilometers of rock with ever-increasing pressure and temperature in the way, you can see this is not an easy thing for us to sample, no matter how interested and motivated one might be. For some perspective on how far off we are from accessing even the outer surface of the outer core of Earth, the deepest hole ever dug, the Kola Superdeep Borehole, is only about 12 kilometers deep. That is less than 0.5% of the way there, and that project took more than 20 years. The Kola Giant Hola was abandoned due to a combination of higher-than-expected temperatures in the drill hole and the collapse of the Soviet Union, which didn't help the funding situation for digging a really deep hole. In case you were looking for a fun vacation destination with the kids, the site is now abandoned and an environmental hazard, so it likely will not be crowded. So, as you can see, iron meteorites represent something we do not have access to on Earth, allowing us to much better understand what happens at the center of a planetary body. Compared to more silicate-rich rocks, iron meteorites are heavily represented in the world's meteorite collections, likely well beyond their relative abundances in space. This is for a couple of reasons. First, they are far more durable than most other rocks, and they routinely survive the journey through the atmosphere and earthly impact with the expected grace and robustness you would expect of a lump of iron. Second, as discussed, they are unusual hunks of metal, so they are easily recognized and collected as extraterrestrial visitors, whereas silicate-rich samples can better camouflage their origin to collectors. Stony iron meteorites, core mantle boundary region. I will be honest. I don't really understand stony iron meteorites, but I promise you, my ignorance is not lonely on this subject. Stony irons bridge the gap between the iron meteorites of planetary cores and silica-rich crustal-style rocks we are more familiar with. It is speculated they come from something like the core mantle boundary layer of destroyed planetesimals, but this is still a hotly debated topic. Because most stony irons contain approximately equal parts, metal and silicate, it makes perfect sense they are placed between the iron meteorites, almost all iron, and the stony meteorites, almost all silicate. A class of stony irons called palisites are the most famous members of the type and are generally about 50% iron nickel metal and about 50% of the mineral olivine. This cosmic combo can make palisites very beautiful to look at. Brilliant green olivine crystals encased in a shiny metal matrix make for an otherworldly appearance and command a high price from collectors. Interestingly, it was the unique appearance and characteristics of the first known palisite that helped convince the scientific community that rocks could come from somewhere other than Earth. This would be the Krasnoyarsk meteorite, discovered by the German naturalist Peter Palis, whom we discussed previously, and the class palisite is named. As you can imagine, this realization was a big deal for the meteoritic community. Other stony irons, like the mesosiderites, are less well known, possibly because they are much uglier and humans are incredibly shallow beings, especially when it comes to rock collecting. Stony meteorites, crust and mantle samples. Meteorites that derive from the crust and mantle of their parent bodies are certainly the most difficult to recognize as meteorites. In most cases, they don't look that different from terrestrial crustal samples, and there are undoubtedly untold thousands just lying around waiting to be identified as meteorites. Those that we have recognized as extraterrestrial have truly been a boon for our understanding of all differentiated bodies in the solar system. The term differentiated is used to describe a body that has separated itself into crust and or mantle and a metallic core. There are many types of achondrites, with the angrite group hosting the oldest known igneous rocks in the solar system, and the eucrite group likely hailing from the asteroid 4 Vesta, the second largest object in the asteroid belt. And whereas these and other groups have provided a wealth of scientific information, by far the most sought-after achondrites are meteorites from the moon, and even more so from Mars. Similar to Earth, the other large bodies of the solar system have been continuously pelted by impacts for the last 4.5 billion plus years. Sometimes those impacts are large enough to excavate parts of the surface material where it lands and send various bits hurtling out into space. And as you may guess, sometimes Earth crosses paths with such liberated planetary material, increasing its ever-expanding alien rock budget to include pieces of the Moon and Mars. If you think it's pretty awesome that we have chunks of rock that were blasted off the surfaces of these bodies, you are right. It's awesome. Of course, for the Moon, we have been there and returned select samples to Earth, which have given us incredible insight into not only how and when the Moon formed, but answers to a bundle of important scientific questions we would have struggled to answer any other way. These returned lunar samples also showed us that some of the meteorites in our collections were of lunar origin. Lunar meteorites have greatly complemented this archive of lunar material, and we have greater than 450 identified meteorites that came from the surface of the Moon. As for Mars, well, Martian meteorites are, as of yet, the only physical pieces of the red planet we have to understand its history, so they represent an invaluable resource. As discussed in Chapter 6, based on what we have learned from the multiple unpiloted missions and/or probes sent to Mars over the decades, Mars has an incredibly captivating history that includes volcanoes, glaciers, periods of liquid water, and environments potentially suitable for the development of life, even prior to when such conditions were present on Earth. Regardless of the classification any particular space rock belongs to, it's carrying a wealth of information about the formation and/or evolution of our solar system. Lunar meteorites sample parts of the Moon we have not been to. Pieces of Mars teach us about the long and interesting history of our planetary neighbor. Iron meteorites instruct us on the behavior of planetary cores and inform us about what is and what happens far underneath our own feet on Earth. Various types of achondrites illuminate the stories of planets that never were, broken up in violent collisions. Different still are the primitive meteorites that act as snapshots of the earliest epoch of our solar system, sampling an only slightly modified version of the parent molecular cloud from which the solar system formed. Indeed, the differences between meteorites are considerable. Yet since each unique type teaches us something different about our solar system history and evolution, they all provide important information we would struggle to gather without their existence.